Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 2014, Ohio executed convicted murderer Dennis McGuire with a new combination of drugs that cast a further shadow on the issue of capital punishment. Witnesses reported that McGuire appeared to gasp and choke during the more than 20-minute process. That was the last execution in Ohio, which, like other death penalty states, has struggled with pharmaceutical companies and distributors over using the drugs to kill. Another execution was scheduled for February 15th. Today, until a federal judge in January ruled that Ohio's new three-drug protocol is unconstitutional. We're looking at capital punishment in Ohio and across the country this hour. Associated Press legal affairs reporter Andrew Welsh Huggins is author of the 2009 book, No Winners Here Tonight, Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States. He joins us now. Welcome back, Andrew.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Ohio State University law professor Douglas Berman has served on the Chief Justice's Joint Task Force to review the administration of Ohio's death penalty and is the author of the 2016 article in the Duke Journal of Constitutional Law and Public Policy entitled The Challenges of Improving the Modern Death Penalty. He joins us as well. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, Ann.
The Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections postponed all executions to 2017 because of the difficulty obtaining the drugs they needed. Andrew, go over why Ohio has had a difficulty with this.
Ohio's had the same problem that so many other states have had. The state used a standard three-drug protocol for almost two decades. And then for a lot of reasons, largely activists putting a lot of pressure for the first time on pharmaceutical makers, particularly in Europe where a lot of those companies are based, the drugs that this Ohio and other states use basically dried up, disappeared. They were put off limits. And Ohio basically could not find drugs for a long time. And eventually they came up with a new two-drug system. They had used a single dose of a barbiturate for several years and, you know, putting this in quotes, they had successfully carried out many executions with that one drug. But then that drug was no longer available. They went with a two-drug approach. They used that on Dennis McGuire. And as you said, it took him 26 minutes to die. He choked or he sort of snorted and gasped the whole time. It looked very uncomfortable. The state stopped after that, went back to the drawing board, and now they've come forward and they have a supply of a new three-drug protocol. And basically it's the first drug in that system, which is a sedative called midazolam. That's really at the heart of the current problem, the current debate in terms of Ohio's system.
Doug Berman, how does a judge decide whether a drug is constitutional or not to use in this way?
Well, that's part of the problem is we don't really have great standards. The Supreme Court has had two cases in which it's tried to set forth standards for articulating what drug protocol is sufficient constitutionally. And the core of both of those cases is to state that it's inappropriate for a state to use a protocol that creates a significant risk of unnecessary pain. And when the Supreme Court first announced that in a case called Bayes, the thought was, OK, you know, that makes it clear for states that as long as they're coming up with ways that don't create a big risk of unnecessary pain, they're going to be OK. But in an awful lot of litigation, defense attorneys and their scientists have been very effective at highlighting that there's really no drug protocol that can be perfectly administered that perfectly guarantees there isn't at least some risk of some pain unless they're using that one drug protocol, phenobarbital. It seems like everybody agrees that was sort of the best of all possible
ways of
doing
it. Back when there was the three-drug protocol.
Actually, the one-drug approach that Ohio had engineered using phenobarbital, it seemed like that has been sort of deemed as successful as possible at reducing pain. But when that drug dried up, the turn to other drugs has engineered a new wave of litigation, in part because advocates for death row folks have said, hey, it's not our fault you can't get that drug, and that's the safe way or at least the least risky way to do it, and these other drugs you're trying out are more risky. The Supreme Court entered the fray in a case called Glossop, where they seem to say, look, if other drugs are unavailable, all the state has to do is come up with kind of the best means they can come up with. And that's why Ohio felt confident going forward again. Even though they couldn't get the phenobarbital, they believed that this new protocol with three drugs, with milazodan at the start, was good enough constitutionally. That's what the litigation was in the lower courts here in Ohio, and that's what's going to be playing out possibly this entire year and getting all the way back up to the Supreme Court.
So what is it about phenobarbital that works so well?
Think of it as the way a pet is euthanized. It simply puts the inmate into a fatally deep sleep.
Okay.
And the other drugs that are traditionally used, one is a paralytic, and there's always been questions about what pain is the inmate feeling with the paralytic, and the other drug stops the heart. And again, questions about do those drugs cause pain. But with phenobarbital, there's never been a question that would cause pain. You simply, when you watch these executions with phenobarbital, it truly looks like someone is just falling asleep and then they stop moving.
What do the drug companies say? You're saying that political opponents of the death penalty have brought political pressure to bear on those companies?
For sure, yeah. And this happened beginning back in the 2000s and then going forward. One question I've never really gotten a good answer to is why the pressure started then and not for the three decades before that. I don't know. But starting in the 2000s and then onward, there was a lot of pressure put on the drug makers to stop making these drugs available for executions. And the drug makers listened, and almost, in fact, as far as I can tell, all the drug makers, and then very importantly, the big three distributors, and that would include Cardinal Health here in suburban Columbus, also agreed to put these drugs off limits for use in executions. Now, that still leaves, I guess you call it a gray market, that those drugs could be circulating out there and states have been able to obtain them. And it appears that's what Ohio has done with the three drugs, with the supply it has now. As far as I can tell, they have enough drugs on hand for several executions.
But all things being equal, even though it's been ruled unconstitutional by the federal judge, right?
That's correct. And as Doug was hinting, this goes before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals next week, I believe. And, you know, the state feels it has a very strong argument on appeal, and they're anticipating that judge's ruling being rejected and that they can proceed with an execution starting in May.
Is the Sixth in Cincinnati?
Yeah, it's based in Cincinnati, but it's, you know, got judges from multiple states that
it
covers.
Right. What is the case's argument? I mean, what is the state's argument?
The state's argument is very much relying on this Glossop decision, which came out of Oklahoma and actually involved the first drug in the protocol, milazodan, and the justices led by Justice Alito, who expressed both an oral argument and to some extent in the written opinion in Glossop, which was a couple years ago, that it's inappropriate to allow activists who have been advocating to try to dry up the supplies of these other drugs to functionally end the death penalty. And the theme the Supreme Court emphasized in Glossop was if the death penalty is constitutional, there has to be a constitutional way to administer it. And so therefore, and this was the logic of Glossop, as long as the state sort of tries its best to utilize the best available means, right? And so that's what the state is pressing. Look, we'd use phenobarbital if we could get it. We'd use other drugs if we could get it. We can't get them. This is the best available protocol we can come up with, and therefore it must be constitutional. Otherwise, you're essentially de facto making the operation of the death penalty unconstitutional.
Isn't that what they're trying to do with the abortion rights, though? And they're with all of the limitations on abortions at the state level? Isn't it the exact same thing?
I certainly you could say, and I think it's an interesting point, that activists—
It just sounds like we could be talking about that right now.
Activists who are opposed to whatever activity we're talking about will often use practical means to try to halt a process if they can't get that halted, you know, legally, constitutionally through operative law. Mm-hmm. Again, these are coming together because the Supreme Court has said in this Glossop case, and it was very much Glossop that the state has relied on in the lower court and will be relying on in the Sixth Circuit and probably will go up to the Supreme Court if they have to, that, look, as long as we've shown we're trying to do this the best possible way, you have to let us go forward. And, of course, the defense responds, no, that's not how the standard should work at all. If there still is this significant risk of unnecessary pain, you don't get to go forward with the less good drug. And that's kind of the terms of the debate that the lower court ultimately kind of found on the defense side, but that the state feels very adamantly that they looked at the standard the wrong way. And that's, again, why I think we're going to see litigation perhaps throughout the year in the Sixth Circuit and ultimately up to the Supreme Court.
Andrew Welsh Huggins, do they experiment with these drugs? How do they figure out what's going to work and what doesn't?
They don't experiment with them in Ohio. They rely on expert witnesses for years. They just relied on the experience of other states. Keep in mind, a lot of states have been carrying out executions by the time Ohio carried out its first execution in 99.
In modern times,
under the new law. But that's a good question. How do they know? And in this current, under this current system, so in 2004, they used two drugs. The first one was midazolam, this drug that's at the focus of this debate. And I'm pretty sure the dose they used in that case was 50 milligrams, which is a far, far bigger dose than would ever be used in surgery. By contrast, they've upped that to 500 milligrams for this new protocol for executing inmates.
That didn't take place today, right?
Right, and may take place on May 10th. And they've based that, you know, other states have used that amount. So basically, they've just determined that a supermassive dose of midazolam is the way to go. And I'm sort of speculating here, but one thing you could look at is they looked at what happened with Dennis McGuire in 2014 and said, well, with 50 milligrams, that didn't seem to work. One of the issues with midazolam that's been debated back and forth is that it's not like pentobarbital, and there's an entire debate over what's known as the ceiling effect with midazolam. In other words, does a massive dose really matter? Is there a point at which it's not going to affect the inmate one way or the other, and he may still not be completely unconscious, and it doesn't matter if you give him 500 milligrams or 1,000, that there's the ceiling where it doesn't take effect anymore. Obviously, the state argues that this is going to work, and the attorneys for the death penalties are saying the exact opposite.
And Doug Berman, refresh our memories on where the whole cruel and unusual thing comes from when it comes to a death penalty. I mean, are you supposed to feel no pain?
Well,
what's the threshold there?
Again, yeah, it's the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishments. And there's been a long line of precedent, not just in the context of the death penalty, that says it's not just the choice of punishments that are subject to that limitation, but how they get administered. So there's even a whole jurisprudence about what might be cruel and unusual punishment in the prison setting. And starting really from the start of a robust modern court reviewing the work of particularly state capital processes, the Supreme Court has struggled its way through what qualifies as cruel and unusual punishment in the actual carrying out of a death sentence. And there really hasn't been a truly robust jurisprudence to work through in any setting. That, in fact, technically, neither the electric chair nor hanging nor firing squads have ever gotten sort of formally in front of the Supreme Court in modern times to ask whether those are cruel and unusual punishment approaches. And that's been part of the backstory of why states continue to sort of struggle through using different combinations of drugs, even as they've dried up, is even though we have these old historical methods, we've not yet had a modern Supreme Court articulate a set of standards beyond what I mentioned before in that Bayes case, that it's clearly inappropriate or it's been declared unconstitutional if a state were to use a method that creates a significant risk of unnecessary pain. But again, every word in that formulation can be subject and is subject to litigation. What's a significant risk rather than just an insignificant risk?
And what's unnecessary versus necessary.
Exactly. And so that's where the state is always eager to say, and to some degree, I give the state credit. You don't have any state that goes forward and says, we want to create a lot of pain. We want this to be a tortured execution. They just say, we're trying our best, and it should be, in a sense, good enough for government work. And the defense and defense attorneys and their clients are saying that's just not good enough in this context unless you have something that's, I don't want to quite say foolproof, but is certain not to create this risk of pain. You need to try something else. And, you know, what you were talking with Andrew before highlights one of their best talking points, that a lot of this is not experimented upon in any sensible way. Nobody's doing, you know, how do we kill experiments in a...
they're not testing mice or anything.
Exactly. And so, and even if they did, whether that carries over to a right. human subject. And so the defense often says in these settings, every new protocol is a form of human experimentation, and that itself is cruel and unusual. And especially here in Ohio, where that two-drug approach was novel for Dennis McGuire and didn't go well, I think that's created a background condition for the litigation here in Ohio that leads judges and others to be kind of distinctly concerned about any time Ohio comes up with a new protocol and says, hey, we've got it right now.
We're talking about the death penalty. The Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections has postponed executions or had to 2017, in fact, to today, February 15th. The federal judge has ruled, though, that the protocol that was planned for today was unconstitutional. So now the next execution has been pushed back to May 10th, all things being equal. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This hour, we're talking about the status of capital punishment in Ohio and across the nation. The first execution in Ohio in 3 years was scheduled for February 15th, today, until a federal judge intervened in January, ruling the current mix of death penalty drugs unconstitutional. Governor Kasich has now pushed back the execution's schedule to begin again in May. Still with us is Associated Press legal affairs reporter Andrew Welsh Huggins and OSU law professor and death penalty expert Douglas Berman. We've been talking about what those drug protocols have been in the past and why it's been difficult to get the drugs that are generally believed to be the least painful and the most effective. It's because the pharmaceutical companies and most importantly, their distribution company, the distribution companies out there, because of political pressure, have stopped selling to the states for this purpose. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment. And David in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Good morning, Ann.
Go ahead.
I have a question for your panel, but first let me preface it by saying that I'm convinced capital punishment should be unconstitutional. It would require an amendment expunging reference to deprive of life in the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment. I know it's not that simple, but it is that simple. But my question is, I remember waking up in recovery after abdominal surgery. I had 2 surettes of morphine, and I asked the nurse for a third, and she said, no, it might kill you. So I'm thinking, why not use an overdose of morphine in executions? It would be painless. It's commonly available. Would it disappoint some expectation of vengeance and cruelty? I'm puzzled. Why not use morphine?
Okay. Andrew Welsh Huggins?
So it's a good question and one I hear a lot. Probably the simple answer is that's going to fall right into the same situation we're in now. The state could come forward with a proposal that in the future executions will be carried out with a single powerful dose of morphine, and that would then launch an entire new set of litigation. And, you know, and by the way, we've seen lawmakers here and I believe elsewhere take the same approach even farther and say, fairly callously in my opinion, but, you know, well, we have all these people dying from heroin overdoses. Why can't the state just get some of that heroin and use that?
Mm-hmm.
And then I will also say you raised another good point that people often forget that capital punishment in the United States is not meant as to be punitive. It's simply the ultimate sentence. And so it's certainly, although people have very strong feelings about what should be done to people who've committed some of these slayings, the process of killing them is not meant to be painful or to exact some kind of final justice. The fact that you are putting someone to death, that they are losing their life, that's meant to be the punishment.
Okay. That's pretty severe punishment, though. It's called capital punishment.
Well, and I think that's the point, that the punishment is the most severe. You are casting someone out of society by taking their life. That's the ultimate punishment.
I'll add, and it's heard from not just some death penalty advocates, but you know, certainly I think it reflects a public sentiment that's not hard to understand for almost everybody subject to capital punishment. They inflicted, in some sense, a torturous death on their victim. And I think there are more than a few people who are inclined to say, sure, the state should try to avoid torturing the death row defendant while they're executing them. But gosh, why are we working so hard? Why does this person justify so much time and attention to have to extinguish every possible risk? I use the phrase good enough for government work. I think that's a widespread sentiment that as long as the state isn't trying to torture the defendant in the execution process, that it's going too far to demand that the state try to extinguish every possibility that something could possibly go wrong. In fact, I think it was that sentiment that for quite some time delayed much debate over execution methods as it relates to lethal injection. In fact, most states turned to lethal injection, again, because they were concerned that maybe the electric chair or hanging or other methods that were on the books was painful and torturous. And so lethal injection initially looked as though it was the humane method, and states turned to it very much in good faith, hoping to, again, as Andrew was suggesting, just have death be the punishment rather than a torturous death. Some scientific studies and some advocacy showed not only the possibility in the old three-drug protocol that there was just a masking of the pain that the inmate might be feeling during the execution process, but then some litigation in California and Missouri and a few other states highlighted actually how Keystone Copish some of the execution teams were. They didn't have anybody with any expertise medically doing the procedures. Often they were mixing up the drugs. In California, there was evidence that there was some of the drugs were being stolen and sold on the black market. And so as the kind of rock was lifted on this process, which seemed more humane, that itself started to highlight some of the problems in the way in which states were using this execution method. And that led to the modern litigation.
What are the rules about who administers the drugs in Ohio, Andrew?
Well, they're all volunteers. They work probably all for the prison system. I don't believe there's...
They don't have to be a doctor, though, or anything like that?
No. In fact, I don't know if that's prohibited, but it's certainly... Doug maybe can back me up on this, but I don't think there's anything in statute that says what the executioners have to be. Typically, they're individuals with some experience inserting needles, meaning some sort of first responder, a lot of EMTs, if I'm using the phraseology correctly, people who have had experience inserting needles into veins. And, you know, we've seen some infamous examples of how that went wrong. Rommel Broom in 2009, the probably the best example. They tried for 2 hours unsuccessfully to put him to death and then just stopped, and he's still on death row. So, we don't know who these executioners are. That has all shielded. We have a sense, based on anonymous testimony they've given, that, again, they've got some experience, probably as EMTs, putting needles in.
And that's been one of the problems, is I know Ohio and other states have tried to reach out to people in the medical profession, doctors, nurses, to get their help. Again, recognizing that this is a challenging thing to do without people with some expertise and understanding of the, sort of the physiology behind this. But generally speaking, doctors have been very resistant to providing any help. Some of them will say, you know, part of their Hippocratic Oath means they can't be involved in this process. Others are concerned, even if they're open to being involved, that they would be subject to pressure and advocacy groups coming out against them, and that could hurt other work that they do. And so it's been, again, you know, I want to give the state as much credit as they deserve. They don't want this to be torturous. They want to carry out the death sentence without having these problems, but it's proved practically, because of the shortage of drugs and the challenge of personnel, awfully difficult to make work.
Email from Chris. If we are simply trying to put people to death, why not go back to tried and true methods such as the guillotine or firing squad? Why can't we give the prisoner the option of how they would like to die? It seems that the use of drugs makes it more comfortable for those doing the killing, as it looks less gruesome.
That's been an approach that a number of states have been moving to, especially with this lethal injection litigation. One quasi-popular option lately has been talking about nitrogen gas. The gas chamber using other gases were popular as a possibility before World War II and the problems that you know, the Nazis used this in such horrific ways. And so every execution method comes baggaged with both the challenges of carrying it out and different sets of stigma that indisputably would lead to litigation, right? Huh. So that's the part that is the extra layer of challenge at this point. Is, I think, most states, including Ohio's attitude, is, look, we've had at least enough litigation success with lethal injection that let's try to make that work rather than open a whole new frontier of litigation over some other method. Though it's certainly possible, and Mississippi just this week had a bill trying a bunch of other methods as well, that one or two states frustrated by this process will eventually move forward and get the courts to approve going back to one of those old methods.
Email from Justin. He asks, why don't the states produce their own supply of the original drug, the drug that was effective but can't be obtained now, I guess, pentobarbital? That puts that, states in the business of producing drugs.
Yeah, that has come up. Part of the issue there, I mean, the state was very open about that very issue in one of its recent filings, where it explained its difficulty finding both pentobarbital and the active ingredient in pentobarbital, which it said it had also sought out. Now, not to make it itself, but what Ohio was trying to do is to obtain the active ingredient in that drug so that a compounding pharmacy could make it for the state. And this appears to be what's happening in other states as well. There are new laws and new case law in Ohio that, in theory, would protect the identity of that compounding pharmacy. You'd never know who was making it. Now, if you were a compounding pharmacy, you'd have to be willing to take a leap of faith that you would never be identified as the source. In terms of states themselves, like setting up a laboratory, I'm not aware of that happening or being under consideration. I think it'd probably be fairly difficult.
All right. So Ohio passed a law allowing the state to keep the names of the drug suppliers, in this case, the compounding pharmacies, secret. Have there been challenges to that? I would imagine there have been. Where are those at?
The Sixth Circuit, Doug helped me out here, but the Sixth Circuit ruled late last year.
Yeah, just
to uphold the Shield law.
Okay.
Yeah. And again, this is where, you know, every turn that the state goes to is subject to one or another round of litigation. And those are entirely appropriate concerns expressed by defendants and defense attorneys. They say, look, how can we even know what the drugs are that you're claiming are coming from this compounding pharmacy unless we can know what the pharmacy is, and we can potentially question them in litigation to understand how they put this drug together. And so, you know, Ohio moved to I was actually Attorney General DeWine who encouraged the General Assembly to pass this bill that said the only way we're going to get the drugs potentially is if we pass this bill that keeps secret, that hides from scrutiny, whatever pharmacy we might be able to get to help us make and obtain these drugs for use in executions. But again, not only did that lead to litigation, it hasn't created a solution because it's not clear that they've gotten the drugs from these pharmacies and that the source of the drugs from the get-go have been subject to uncertainty and different levels of disclosure. The state says, look, we have the drugs. Let's fight about the drugs and our desire to use it, not where they came from. Whereas the defense says, no, how can we have a sensible fight over the nature of these drugs and whether they'll work if we don't know where you got them?
Right. OK. And so the email from Susan, I don't mean to be glib, she writes, but I am wondering why we cannot use fentanyl or carfentanil for the death penalty drugs. They seem to work extremely well and very quickly. Did you already say that, well, you just push the political pressure onto the drug companies that produce those drugs?
Well, yeah. And
I mean, those would dry up, too.
Or it would depend on how you're obtaining them. I will say carfentanil is this new, they call it the elephant sedative. It's so powerful. Yeah. They use it. And, you know, carfentanil is so dangerous that law enforcement agencies are advised now to basically put on biohazard material if they think they're going after carfentanil.
Okay.
So I think that would be dangerous all around. Again, fentanyl gets into this exact same thing. It would launch a new round of litigation and might ultimately be proved successful. But I guarantee you, if Ohio adopted fentanyl as its method tomorrow, executions would be put off until 2019 easily.
And I think a part of the story, especially for drugs, you know, previously talking about morphine, you know, if you were talking about opioids now, that there's this consistent concern, a concern that I'm sure the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction hears from hospitals, from doctors. Look, don't use a drug that is integral to actual medical procedures, because that creates all sorts of problems for us as medical institutions. We get problems from patients who say, wait a minute, you're giving me a drug that's being used to kill people? I don't want that drug. And that creates its own set of difficulties. You get problems. This has been where I think hospitals and doctors' organizations have been effective at drawing up the supply of these other sedatives by saying, look, we're not going to order drugs from you if you're also providing those drugs for executions, because we don't want to have to tell our patients that we're using drugs that are being used in executions. And that's why those companies, it's not just those companies are being run by people who don't like the death penalty. It's they have a business bottom line. They need to keep their customers happy, which are hospitals and doctors. And so you move to fentanyl, you move to morphine, you're going to reinvigorate those sets of concerns that are, again, part of where anytime you medicalize this procedure, you create a new echo of problems with a different population.
Here's Brad in Clintonville with another idea. Hi, Brad. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Great conversation. I have an idea that I feel would help the whole of society, and it also would eliminate this whole conversation you all are having today about what drug to use or along those lines. We need to keep the perpetrators alive, not kill them. And it's not that I'm against the death penalty. It's just that the punishment, the whole idea of punishment, I understand. But we don't need to do the death penalty. We can keep them alive and study them. Do spec scans, PET scans, CAT scans, blood tests to look at their hormonal levels, their serotonin levels, their testosterone levels. We can study them emotionally, psychologically, and therefore get data, gather data. Look for patterns in society, in other people who are not incarcerated or who have had problems with sociologists or with their psychiatrists or with their social workers. Look for patterns. People who haven't perpetrated crimes get tested, too. They get health screenings. Gather the data. Look for patterns. Mm. Maybe we can prevent killers in the future from killing with some type of treatment.
Okay. Well, has this, Andrew Walsh Huggins, has that ever been raised?
In terms of the scientific aspect of studying them, I don't think I've ever heard it raised as an alternative to capital punishment, but the one immediate thing it brings to mind is a proposal in Colorado that would have banned capital punishment and taken all the resources the state spends on that and put them into a reinvigorated investigation of old homicides.
Huh.
And that my recollection is that may have passed the Colorado House. That came pretty close because, you know, there are a lot of law and order people who liked the idea of that. I mean, regardless of how you feel about capital punishment, we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on each case. By the way, that's not like keeping them in prison and the cost of executing them. That's actually not that much. That's just the ongoing litigation. And so there's an argument for diverting those resources into solving the hundreds of cold case murders in Ohio and elsewhere. In terms of examining the inmates themselves, I think there's always an argument to be made for from a criminological standpoint for trying to understand why people did what they do. We often get a big sense of this during the trial as experts examine these offenders, and certainly in the clemency stage, there are huge amounts of information come out about these inmates' background and, you know, big surprise. A lot of them grew up in chaotic households, abuse, substance abuse left and right. Whether there's been any effort to put all that together and compile it, I'm not aware of it. But certainly a database like that would be helpful.
Brad in Clintonville, thanks a lot for that call. We are going to hear from, coming up next, a state lawmaker who wants to expand the penalties or expand the use of death penalty to certain cases. So we'll hear from him when we return. We'll continue talking with Douglas Berman, OSU law professor and death penalty expert, and also Andrew Walsh Huggins, legal affairs reporter for the Associated Press and author of the book No Winners Here Tonight, Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the state of the death penalty in Ohio and across the country. It's come to almost a standstill because of challenges to the drugs that the states want to use in the death penalty process. Still with us is Associated Press legal affairs reporter Andrew Walsh Huggins, also OSU law professor and death penalty expert Douglas Berman. Joining us now by phone is State Representative Dave Greenspan. He's a Republican from Westlake. That's a community west of Cleveland along the lake. Representative Greenspan has introduced a bill that would, among other things, allow the death penalty option in cases of murder of first responders and military personnel. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity to be on.
Why is this law needed?
Well, let's understand first what current law is in Ohio. Current law in Ohio basically states that if there is a premeditated attack, I'll use those words, although that's not explicitly spelled out that way in the Ohio Revised Code, against a law enforcement officer in Ohio, that the penalty, should that offender be found guilty or pled guilty, is life in prison, death penalty eligible, not eligible for parole. As we've seen across – so that's the current law in Ohio. As we've seen across our country, and we've seen attacks here in Ohio recently against first responders in Youngstown in early December, there's been an increase in attacks against first responders. Ohio's law is only limited to law enforcement officers. So what my bill intends to do is to broaden those covered by the same protection that's offered to law enforcement officers to first responders. So that would include firefighters, EMTs, and others trained in emergency and first response. The bill also expands into military members as well, as we've seen active attacks, premeditated attacks against members of the military, whether we're looking at Fort Hood, whether we're looking at Chattanooga, Tennessee. This bill simply expands the current definition of law enforcement officer penalties to those related groups, those folks who see us at our worst, at our greatest times of need, and those who protect and defend our liberties and freedom. That's the intent of the law.
So
it doesn't, you know, yeah.
Well, if I premeditated murder and achieved that goal against a police officer, an EMT, a firefighter, that kind of a thing, you're saying that they
right.
couldn't use the death penalty against me now?
They currently could, correct.
Right, they could.
They currently could.
Right,
right.
So what's the diff?
What we're, Well, the difference here, this basically provides the let's put it this way. Under as a law enforcement officer, yes, that's currently written into the law as the sentencing guidelines are outlined.
Mm-hmm.
For an attack against a firefighter, an EMT, or a member of the military, the law is not explicit in that definition. So what this bill intends to do is make that an explicit penalty as it relates to a premeditated attack.
Why?
So right now it is not explicitly stated that way in the Ohio Revised Code for a first responder other than, or members of the military, other than a law enforcement officer. It also doesn't include federal law enforcement officers, the current law. My bill seeks to include that group in this class as well.
Is that because federal law doesn't call for it at all, or?
No, just Ohio law does not offer it. So
okay.
We're providing that same level of penalty.
Why do you think this is necessary? I mean, since it's it's an option anyway.
It's an option. This elevates it to a higher level for a premeditated attack against a first responder member of the military. You know, we've seen, and unfortunately the statistics aren't as well kept for non-law enforcement officers. However, with law enforcement officers alone, last year there were more premeditated ambush attacks nationwide against law enforcement officers than in nearly the past two decades. So clearly there's been an escalation of these types of attacks. We need to provide support for our first responders and members of the military and demonstrate as a state that we stand behind them and with them, and we will provide as much protection as we can to deter acts of violence against those first responders and members of the military.
And Representative Greenspan, you're convinced that having the threat of the death penalty which is already an option, but having the threat of that is going to what? Is it, you think it will deter people?
Well, the expectation is penalty is a deterrent to any activity, correct? I mean, if you run a stoplight or a stop sign and you speed and you're caught, the deterrent is you're going to pay a fine and get points on your insurance. Now, it doesn't mean people don't speed and don't run stop signs, but there is a penalty. There is a deterrent should you do that. This is intended to do that to have the same impact. You know, if we demonstrate and stand behind our first responders and members of the military and let those who seek to harm them know that we will not tolerate that here in Ohio, yes, it is my intent and my expectation this will serve as some form of a deterrent.
Now, Douglas Berman, as far as that purpose for the death penalty, is that recognized in law?
It's certainly recognized as a legitimate reason to pursue the death penalty or any other punishment. The empirical studies are all over the map, and it's subject to
whether or not it truly does achieve that.
Correct, and it's an extraordinary subject of debate that I talk to my students about. Boy, if we could get a clear answer to this, it would make the broader debate over the death penalty a lot easier. Because I think if we had conclusive evidence about a significant deterrent effect, it would really make it easy for almost everybody to at least be supportive of and understanding of why pursuing the death penalty can be beneficial for society. There are some, though, that also suggest, and there's some studies to support this, that the death penalty can have a kind of brutalization effect, that having the death penalty on the books might not only not deter homicides but create a culture and an environment that is more violent. Again, you can find a study for just about everything, and one of the things that's been particularly interesting over the last couple decades is how we've had an uptick in executions and then a significant decline over the last 15 years or so. And the relationship between number of executions and number of homicides are hard to link up in any conclusive way. And that's especially if you go state by state. There are 20 states that don't have the death penalty on their books at all now, and arguably another 20 that aren't using it much, if at all. And so, figuring out just what the deterrent impact is, but it's a completely legitimate and appropriate goal to be pursued in any legislative proposal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Andrew Welsh Huggins, is there anything we know about Ohio and deterrent? I guess it makes me think about the caller we had a little earlier saying we should study them. It's kind of like, well, in the absence of the death penalty, what would you study? But I wonder, when people are convicted of a crime that calls for the death penalty and they are given the death penalty, does anyone ever ask him, did you ever think you might get the death penalty? If you had thought about that, would you not have done this?
I haven't seen that posed in a particular way. I think based on the defenses I've seen over the years that I'm not saying all, but many, a majority of the death penalty cases that I come across involve people who committed acts, yes, premeditated often, not always, but people who committed acts and they simply were not thinking about the possibility that they might, you know, be punished somehow. They were robbing, stealing, raping, burning, and the idea that they reached a moment with the finger on the trigger and said to themselves, "Well, I wonder if I should really do this. I might get the death penalty. That I can't. Yeah. I don't think that's been out there." One question I would have for the representative, putting aside the first responder portion of it, I wonder if ultimately the military personnel proposal would just run up against the wall that if a federal officer of any type was slain, wouldn't that almost automatically bump up to the feds? In other words, they're not going to want to see Ohio go after someone who kills a reservist or shoots a National Guardsman or whatever. That's just automatically going to go to the federal courts. I'm just curious your thoughts on how that would work out.
Very well may be the case. This provides once again another avenue or another venue for these types of crimes to be adjudicated through the state system. And oftentimes we see crimes that are committed both that are infringing upon state and federal law, and the courts make the determination or the prosecutors make the determination as to which is the better venue to hear the case and obviously carry out the sentence. So it very well may be, you know, the way the bill is written as well, it includes especially members of the military who have previously served. So it covers premeditated attacks against former members of the military, not currently.
I wanted to ask you about that. If you were talking about crimes against military while in the you know, in uniform, but you're not. You're talking about anybody previously in the military who was killed like this?
If it's a premeditated attack and they were sought out because they were once a member of the military, yes, this bill does include them.
Okay.
So I'll give you an example. You know, I hate to give examples because I don't want these things to obviously occur, but we've seen these truck run over, you know, incidences that we're seeing in Europe. If you've got a VFW post and they're marching in a 4th of July parade and somebody wants to take their vehicle and run down some veterans, you know, because they were veterans, this bill protects them. If there's an attack against a VFW lodge or an AMVETS, you know, hall, because they were in the military, this bill would protect them, would provide that same level of protection.
Representative Greenspan, thanks for joining us today. Yes. I appreciate your time.
Great. Well, thank you for having me, and I appreciate the time today.
That's Ohio State Representative Dave Greenspan. He's a Republican from Westlake, Ohio. I also want to thank my guest, Douglas Berman, Ohio State University law professor and death penalty expert. Thanks, as always, for joining us, Doug.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Welsh Huggins, legal affairs reporter for the Associated Press. He's the author of No Winners Here Tonight, Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States. And, of course, we're referring to Ohio. There's a 2009 book. A lot's changed since 2009. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Always good to be here, Ann.
Andrew Welsh Huggins. And thanks to the listeners and callers for your help. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.